This is new sound roll. It's sound roll 63, and we're interviewing Al Rojas, and it's camera roll 132.
This is Al Rojas, take one, marker.
Al, I've got a bunch of different things to talk about, but let's jump into the middle of the story. You were telling me before some interesting stories about going out on the boycott in 68. This was when the boycott turned into a national boycott and everyone's ready to leave Delano and you want to know what to do.
I think at that point we'd already been assigned the cities in which we were going to be working out of, and I was assigned to Western Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh being the main target city, urban city. Of course, none of us had ever been out to an urban city or knew what the urban city was like. And that was at, right after the Martin Luther King killing. And so my family and I, Elena, my wife then, and my kids, as we were getting ready to pack and we were leaving, Cesar came over to us and saying, you know, take care, goodbye, make sure you have all your paperwork and all your contacts, and yes, and we got all our, you got all your bags and everything, literally bags, you know, that's what we packed some of our belongings and put them in the UFW little white Chevrolet station wagon. Then I stopped back and I said, this is my chance to ask him the real big question. Cesar, I said, and he looked at me and he said, like, you know, something wrong? I said, no, I want to ask you, how do you do a boycott? He says, I don't know. He said, you're going to go out and you're going to find out how to do it. You mean to say no one knows how to do this thing? No, he says, if we're going to win, but we'll be the first ones to make sure that we know how to do the boycott. So that's why you're going out there. I said, oh, gee, thanks a lot.
And it was true. There wasn't a lot of experience in how to do this at that point, right? There had been a few boycotts, but nothing major.
There hadn't been anything this major. And I think the union had basically put all its cards on the table and said, a meeting in Santa Barbara where we did the planning and coordination decisions, where everyone was going to go out. And that meant covering 32 major cities throughout the United States. And that meant La Paz, I mean, back then Delano being vacated because of the kinds of things that the union had gone through then.
And so you got up there to Western Pennsylvania. What was that like, being just alone in this city where you didn't know people?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in the San Joaquin Valley. And we worked, and I was a farm worker. My father was a farm worker and Mexican from Michoacan. All we knew was the vineyards and the orchards and the rural areas in around Tulare County, Visalia, Puerto Rico, and Delano. When we first entered what we called the Pittsburgh area, we had no idea that it rained in June or July back east. And all of a sudden, we went in with a bang. A big wash come down, rain, and all of a sudden, we went through this huge tunnel, and all of a sudden, there's this huge, big city that we had been promised, because I asked Cesar, I said, how big is Pittsburgh? Oh, it's just a small mining town, you know, back east. You know, don't worry about it. You know, you'll do all right. You know. Lo and behold, it's like a 3.5 million population city. It was a real experience because when we arrived, it was like we arrived in the, with our contacts were in the ghetto, in the black community, in African American community in Pittsburgh. There was a priest, Father McElvain, who we were to meet. He was our first contact. And he was the one that basically took us in, gave us food. And there was three or four other farm workers in my whole family, my kids and my wife. Then, and he made contact with the Steelworkers of America. And I remember they housed us And of course, when they housed us and they said they had a place for us, we thought we're going to a house. And lo and behold, they ended up taking us over to this hotel. And we'd seen doormen in movies and things like that. We would drive up and there's this doorman in this, all his uniform, his little cap, the whole works. And he opens the door for us, and my wife looks at me, a little glazed look, you know, what does he want opening the door? And he says, give me your bags. And I said, well, give him the bags. So all we had was Safeway bags crammed with all kinds of clothes, and we didn't really have luggage. So we gave him the bags. So he was, you know, he was taken aback, literally, that we gave him bags, you know, full of old Safeway, you know, grocery bags, paper bags. So we went up, and they gave us a room up at about the 17th floor, I believe, and Manuel Chavez calls us about 9 o'clock at night. We had bathed, and I think all of us are sleeping in this huge king-size bed. And Manuel calls, and he said, are you guys all right? Is everything okay? I said, Manuel, if this is the way the boycott's going to be, we're going to have a great time, man. We're looking at out at the city of Pittsburgh at the 17th floor. We got room service. We got all kinds of stuff. Anyway, bottom line that.
But that was just a nice start. It was actually pretty hard work, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think what happened is that, of course, I was running around town in this old little VW of mine with boycott gray bumper stickers all over the place, all over the car. And of course, it's a non-union car in a union city. So the steelworkers gave me a real education right away. He said, Rojas, God damn it, just in this town, you don't drive around pushing the union scene in a non-union car, especially a German VW car. So anyway, I corrected that right away. We got us a Plymouth. But I think learning the boycott was difficult for us, because, especially for me, because we were looking for supporters, and we were looking for, you know, people in contact, and we were beginning to bump into other movements, the African American movement, which is the civil rights movement, and also the anti-war movement, which is the end of the war in Vietnam. So we figured we'd cling on to that, and of course we then started to make some inroads with some community groups, student community, and labor. But we got into some, you know, we made some mistakes at times, because we got involved with issues in the Black community, because we supported workers' issues and some racism that was involved. Obviously, us getting support from the labor unions created some problems where the unions were, you know, thinking, well, why are you doing this? Are you involved in this? You know, and we kind of thought that these are issues, our issues too.
Now, the other thing you're talking about the boycott experience was that when you dealt with church groups, that the Jewish community was especially receptive to you on the boycott, and you actually ended up naming your daughter Shalom, which is a very unusual farmer
name.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, we made some very good friends in the Jewish community. One family, Trachtenberg family, and they opened up their house to us. And in fact, the husband was a salesman for Robert Bruce, some sweater company. And we're looking for coats because we didn't have, you know, warm gear for the cold weather and snow. It was through them and meeting people in the Jewish community and organizations that we made some real contact. And there's this real acceptance on the part of the Jewish community. You got to understand that in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at least this urban center, you had the Jewish community, German community, Italian community, all separate little communities. It was like the barrio for us, you know, the Mexican community or the Black community. So we thought, well, these people are minorities like us, you know. So we kind of backed, and I made several mistakes at some meetings when I met with members of organizations, and I didn't have any idea about, you know, this whole question of Jewish and Christian, you know. And then I called them Anglos at times, and sometimes they'd really take it back. You know, we're not Anglos, you know. Don't call us Anglos, you know. So we had a real learning experience in that area. But my wife was pregnant, and Jewish community, you know, asked us in one of the organizational meetings, say, what are you going to name your daughter, you know? And why don't you pick a name that, you know, identifies with Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania? So the word shalom was real meaningful to us because of the essence of it symbolized in the interpretation of peace. So we thought, what better name than shalom? So shalom is born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and of course the Jewish community took a real aback to that. You know, they thought, wow, what a symbolic gesture of, you know, the kinds of affection we had with the Jewish community. So that's where the name came from.
But I mean, it really was a question of adapting, coming out of the San Joaquin Valley, living in Pittsburgh. That was a strange world, wasn't it?
Well, it was because, you know, when we lived in Pittsburgh, we never lived in what we call row housing, where buildings are stuck together. There's no, you know, in between. And your play yard is the front of the house in the street. And there's seven or eight bars in that one block, and you're living in a ghetto. A lot of us were looked on as the Indians, you know. In other words, the American Indians from the West. They didn't look at us as Mexicans, but Black community really took to really accepting us. I mean, we had a hard time getting housing in certain parts of Pittsburgh because some of us were a little bit darker than others, and they thought that we were alien, you know, in some of those areas. But we finally learned that in the boycott, we had to get other people involved.
Stop for a second. We have to change. This is shooting film, not videotape. Every 11 minutes.
We are changing now to camera roll 133. Next up is Al Rojas, take two.
Take two, marker.
So Al, let's switch gears a little bit. You've been organizing over the coast, and at a certain point you talked to Caesar and the farm workers, and then later on you had some relationships with the Teamsters. What do you think motivated the Teamsters? Why do you think they tried to move into agriculture the way they did?
Well, I had worked with the Teamsters through affiliation through an independent union that was led by Oscar Gonzalez in the coast out of San Jose. And that was the original, what I call the original name, United Farm Workers Union. And I was the vice president of that union, and him being the president, other members also. I think what happened was that we formed this union, and we organized basically out in the coast all the way from, say, San Jose down to the Mexican border. And at one point, and we have been supporters of the UFW or the National Farm Workers Organizing Association. And we had at times taken food and clothing down there in support of it. But the Teamsters approached us, and they basically approached us during the period of when they were on strike in 1965. We had been organizing since 1963 in the coast.
So why do you think the Teamsters wanted to get into agriculture?
Well, I really think that they were encouraged by the agricultural interest. And
can you start that over again, because we don't get my question. So say, I think the Teamsters were encouraged. Just don't know when you say they. But start again.
I think that the Teamsters were encouraged, and they were encouraged by the fact that the growers wanted them to come into the picture. And I think the growers, meaning the growers in Delano, and they really felt that they needed somebody to get them off their back. And obviously, the Teamsters in Delano during 1965, things didn't go well for them at all. So I guess how we come in is that they wanted some legitimacy with some real, you know, organizers, you know, who had experience organizing farm workers and being farm workers. So basically, we met with them, and they were doling out all kinds of money. Finally, I just kiddingly told Oscar, tell him we want $20,000 a month. He said, you serious? I said, yeah, tell him. And tell him we want $1,800 a month, you know, and expenses and all that. Well, they bought it. But they wanted proof about, you know, our ability to organize. And we had some boycott activity in L.A. And were able to muster, you know, the numbers of people. But I think really when I look back, I think that they then encouraged us to move into Delano. And I think that's when internally Oscar and I, you know, had a difference of strategy. And I basically said, wrong strategy. They're not going to control and dictate, you know, our independence. They had promised us that. Now they were forcing us to go into Delano.
Well, basically, do you think they wanted you to go into Delano to counteract Caesar's operation?
Absolutely. That's what they wanted.
Did you say that they wanted us to go into?
They wanted us to go into Delano to counter Cesar Chavez and the then NFWA effort, and the Filipinos also involved in, you know, with Cesar. That they wanted to do.
And you know what's interesting is they gave up in 66 after Georgia, but then they came back in Salinas and they kept on coming back. And so they obviously didn't give up this idea of moving into the field.
No, I think what we were hearing in the valley with workers, especially farm workers that blended into working in canneries, is that there was a lot of movement or beginnings of reform movement within the Teamsters and the canneries. Remember, the canneries are integrally tied to agriculture because of the products, and the families and those that work in those canneries are Mexicanos or related to workers who work in fields. So there was this whole thing of maybe we can consolidate farm workers and cannery workers together. There was that discussion with workers out in the field. And in some cases, you know, we were approached, you know, by the Teamsters or people who were looking towards leadership to come in to organize the Teamsters. And we said, hey, we got enough problems with organizing farm workers. But I think that when we were approached, we asked the Teamsters, do we have a guarantee that you're going to stop, you know, if there's a strike in the strawberries, that you're going to pull those trucks and you're going to pull them over and not allow them to go through our picket lines. Bill Grammy then, who was the chief organizer for the effort, said and that, yes, you know, we'll support you. We'll close them off. So it never happened. And that was proven in the big egg ranch in Moore Park when we struck that ranch, and after having signed up the workers there, that was during the UFW experience with Oscar Gonzalez and I, and they never shut down the workers. They didn't oblige.
Well, at a certain point, it's real complicated. I want to say, at a certain point, you decided that the way to organize farm workers was to do it with the UFW. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I think it was we were forced into that situation. The Teamsters basically called us up in a special meeting. Bill Grammy had indicated to Oscar, you know, bring everybody in. We're going to have a meeting. And in Burlingame, and there's discussions going on. We didn't know. We weren't aware of these discussions. At least I wasn't. And all of a sudden, we end up in this church and in this hall, Menlo Park, I believe, and there's Cesar Chavez sitting in the room, and here we walk in, and before you know it, there's discussions about we want to join forces with the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee then now, and the UFW on the coast, which is our group, and that the Teamsters were going to give money to that effort, and we're going to merge the UFW on the coast and the UFWOC in the valley. So
that didn't go anywhere. I mean, nobody came over but you. You were the only person.
Yeah. The only person that came over was
next up is Al Rojas, take three.
What happened to him? Want to go on?
This is take three, marker.
So Al, let's pick up the story about going to the meeting at Filipino Hall.
Well, first of all, when we arrived in Delano, our family, you know, went through a rough time because we were not accepted. Cesar came over to our house and tried to, you know, make us part of the scene. But after we were there, you know, we began to see there was some problems. And there was this one meeting that was called in the Filipino Hall. It was an emergency meeting. I had already known that there was some real serious problems that Cesar had with the where the union was at that point. Low tide, low ebb. There's about 80 of us in the meeting. And there was a discussion on the part of Cesar about, hey, this is coming down and there's heavy stuff about violence and I'm committed to nonviolence and I'm really upset. In fact, he was pissed, you know. And there was this real emotion, people really getting up and some people were yelling and screaming and people were crying. I sat there with my wife and said, this is what we got into? You know, we had seen the union from a different perspective coming from the outside. And all of a sudden we see 80 people there. And after having been there, you know, that long, we knew there was something seriously wrong. So we thought, did we make a mistake? Cesar gets up and he says, after people, you know, finish, he said, I'm leaving the hall. I'm on a fast and I'm going to ask people, those that believe in recommitting themselves to nonviolence. But I'm walking from here to the 40 acres. Those that want to do whatever they want to, you guys make the decision, but I'm going to be at the 40 acres. And it was that night after I got up and I said, I made a speech to people. I said, I can't believe that here we have, you know, the greatest movement that we've ever had and that we're into this kind of a situation. So that night, Leroy Chatfield, about 1 o'clock in the morning, came over to the house and he said, we got to do something. I don't know what to do. What are we going to do? I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I think I know what we need to do. If he's going to go on a fast, then we got to go out and tell the workers. And what we need to do is get the rest of the organizers together and meet and decide that we're not going to leave him alone. We're going to go out to the 40 acres and we're going to go out and tell the workers. And it was from that moment that we went out and to all the farm communities, all the labor camps, and it started.